Hi, I'm Mark Crawford, and welcome to the Creative Educators podcast from RSL Awards. This episode is the first of two panels we recorded at Access Creative London at the 2025 RSL Creative Futures Conference. For this panel, I was joined on stage by Dean of Creative Arts at Hertfordshire University, Dr. Stephen Partridge, Artist Manager Phil Nelson, One Dancers Laura Nicholson, and DBS Director Hannah Phipps. The theme of our discussion was creative futures, and the opinions shared are those of the speakers alone. They don't necessarily reflect the views of RSL Awards. Please be aware, this content also contains some adult language. Okay, enjoy. Let's introduce the panel. To my right,
hi, I am Hannah Phipps. I am the Managing Director of DBS Institute of Music. We are a higher education provider specialising in music, as you might have guessed, with a background in music tech, but now diversifying into all things performance, songwriting, live sound, based in Bristol, Manchester and Plymouth. And I'm a songwriter, producer, performer as well.
Hi, my name is Laura Nicholson. I'm Head of Children and Young People's Dance at One Dance UK. And I get to speak at a lot of things, but this is definitely like the coolest crowd. I can tell there's a lot of musos around. I feel like the nerdiest person ever. So One Dance UK is the national support organisation for dance and also the subject association for dancing schools. So we work to champion dance as an educational subject, as a talent development pathway, and all the way through to professional sector.
Good afternoon. My name's Phil Nelson. I guess I wear three relevant hats. I've been an artist manager all my adult life, and it's lovely to be here on the day where I can say 2 weeks ago, my artist Matt Hales was number one in the singles chart and the albums chart as a writer of and a producer of Olivia Dean's hits, if we've got any Olivia Dean's fans in the audience. That's hat number one. Hat number two, I teach the MA students at BIM London as principal lecturer, and my main hat for today is I run a not-for-profit called Pathways into Music. We seek to bring music industry and music education closer together through courses for artists, a lot of courses for educators, teachers, people who work in hubs, FEHE, talent development organisations. And we run a conference which is all the way up in Manchester. If you know people in education or industry in that area, it's November the 22nd, Band on the Wall, Manchester. That's the end of my advert, if that's all right.
You're plenty more opportunity to advertise stuff later. That's all. We're all good.
Hi, everybody. My name's Stephen Partridge. I wear three and a half hats, I suppose, not in competition.
No, absolutely not.
So I'm Dean of the School of Creative Arts at the University of Hertfordshire. That's my main day job. It's quite a big school, about 3,000 students, about 400 staff, and campuses around the world. Four departments. The biggest area that's most notorious area is animation at the university. It's ranked number one in the country and does well in rankings around the world. Film is the biggest growth area. We're on the doorstep to us, Warner Brothers, Sky Elstree, BBC Studio Works. So we do big projects to align our curriculum with them. So that's my main day job. I run a business, an immersive sort of events, venues type business called Cave. And that keeps me busy and up to date in kind of geek stuff. I am a shameless geek. I still make music. It's been my addiction, my happy addiction, as Nile Rodgers called it, since I was about 12 or 13. And I suppose the reason I mentioned that is it kind of connects me on a personal level to a bit of a crusade that I'm not certainly not alone in. Looking at the, you know, we talk a lot about the fiscal value of music and the need for graduates to make money and all of that. But I think the DCMS report that came around Christmas time, looking at, evaluating the mental health and well-being importance of music being worth, £8 billion a year, was it? Something like that. That growing body of research around the importance, the social importance of creative arts, I think is compelling. And you know, being at a big university that's got a medical school launching next year, that's a particularly interesting realm of research. So they're most of my hats. My other hat is I direct cameras for live music, so I point cameras at bands, mostly in partnership with the Featured Artists Coalition, the music trade body. These days I get to do that in my day job when they let me. So that's me.
Thank you. It's a really important point that you make. It is it's always the conversation about the contribution to the UK economy. And forgive me for talking about music again. I know we've got dance representatives and digital media, but music's my background. And, you know, open days with parents and students, we would frequently talk about that 7.6 billion that the UK economy, that the music brings to it, the 220,000 full-time jobs. But 16-year-olds, we don't get into it for that. That figure doesn't mean anything to the students looking to apply for your courses. So it's the parents love it, mums and dads, it's a proper job and all of that kind of thing. But the well-being and ultimately the self-expression, creativity, that's at the nucleus of why we do things. And it's nice to see that there is perhaps some research around that. Could you expand on that?
There's a growing body of research around it, and you know, you shouldn't apologize for coming at it from a music angle. And the value so transcends the kind of the fiscal dimension of salaries and, you know, what you're going to earn if you study this or that. The mental health and well-being dimension, it's way more complex than I can summarize on a panel in an afternoon. But what kind of interests me, I suppose, is that when young people in particular, it's all ages, people that the value of all forms of art and culture, the research around the mental health benefits of singing, dance, you know, these are data-driven pieces of research that inform economic decisions now. When arts and culture is properly funded and young people have the opportunities to engage, the mental health and well-being dimension keeps people happy enough to be in work and happy enough to function in society. You know, these are antidotes to depression and, you know, off the back of a pandemic with, you know, mental health and well-being being kind of exacerbated in a sustained way. The research, the various strands of the many strands of research, the growing data sets point to a critical moment when it comes to government investment in the arts, or not just government, private investment in the arts, a more joined up plan to invest in the arts for socio-economic reasons.
So what you're saying is that teaching and learning and qualifications value shouldn't, you know, it can be judged on more than just its financial value and jobs. Well, that shouldn't be controversial, should it? But you're absolutely right.
I mean, there are so many strands to this, and I'll shut up in a minute and let everyone else speak, but AI is one that has come up recently. There's a lot of kind of fear-mongering and paranoia around AI. I think we all are aware that I think my kids and eventually grandkids one day are probably going to work fewer hours than I have. I hope so. I'm sick of working five and a half days, 6 days a week. But the idea that AI is going to automate a lot of work that people used to do, I think, you know, we can anticipate possibly during our lifetimes it becoming normalised that we go to 4 or 3 days work a week. What a nice balance that would be. But what does that say is that we're going to have more spare time. What are we going to do in our spare time? It's going to be sport, art, culture, those kinds of interventions that bind us as a society and as communities. So, you know, it's not a peripheral thing, this. This is fundamental to our direction of travel as a society, as a country. So it can't be belittled and underfunded for multiple reasons.
I mean, my brain is sparking off with so many things, but, you know, talking about health and well-being and music and sound in relation to that, it literally permeates every single industry, music and sound, which I think is the same for all arts really. But I met someone recently who is an acoustic engineer for an automobile company. Now, I know nothing about cars, right? I don't even drive, but I now know that there are a whole range of jobs in relation to sound and music within the automobile industry. If you think about it, so the level of noise in the car, so that relates to your safety and well-being. The sounds that, you know, each element of the car makes, there's so many jobs for sound designers in the automobile industry. If you take every single industry and think about how does sound and music permeate our lives, there's just so many opportunities that, you know, even now, 15 years into music education, I'm still learning about, and I think that is incredibly exciting. So for me, working with young people, I know that I'm not going to get a 17-year-old excited about a future potential job working for a car company, or at least very few. But I do know how important it is to help them be able to bridge creativity and technical skills and those innovation skills, that when these opportunities do come their way, they are prepared and able to grasp those, because that connection between creativity and technical fluency, I think, is something that will become even more important, with the rise of AI. It's how can you do the two things together?
It reminds me of one of the workshops we do as part of these educator weekends with teachers of younger people. And I think one of the things we found is there's probably, I don't know if somebody might have done a study on this, do let me know if they have. We reckon that, at about 7 or 8 years old, parents will often have drummed into their young people that they really don't want them thinking about a career in music. This is a bad idea. There's no money in it. It's a dangerous career to get involved with. And I think if a young person's been told that too often at a very young age, it's game over. And so I think one of the things we talk to the teachers about is we use as an example Ed Sheeran on stage in a stadium, 100,000 audience, but there's just Ed on his own on the stage. And we ask the teachers to start to think about the different jobs, the different careers that are needed to get him where he is. And we can usually come up with about 300, and that doesn't include the acoustic engineers of the vehicles that he's travelled in, which might start to get a bit tenuous. Okay. But in terms of everything to do with the live industry, both at the event and elsewhere, the IP that he's created, the record companies, the publishers, the merchandisers, the lawyers, the everything else. And when you show the teachers the 300 different music careers, and then you start to look at the value of music to this country, as you were mentioning, the light bulb moments are huge. And if we can only build that into classrooms at a younger age, perhaps we can actually maybe fight back against the parents who think all of their youngsters should be lawyers and accountants.
It's a good point, and bringing yourself in there on that, in dance and performing arts, what are the similar barriers in terms of, parents supporting young people to train and the reality? What are the jobs out there beyond perhaps being a West End star or being, the equivalent of Ed Sheeran, which is really where all the jobs are, isn't it, as elsewhere?
Yeah, exactly. And there's like a whole kind of hearts and minds piece that we have to work on, because, I won't turn this into a party political broadcast. But we've had however many years of like mainstream media and the government talking about Mickey Mouse subjects, low value, non-priority. And that has drip fed, hasn't it? So that's come from the previous government. It's come through mainstream media. It's gone to parents. It's gone to school leaders. It's gone to young people. It's gone to careers advisors. And, at the risk of sounding 1,000 years old, a lot of the teachers coming through the system now, the young teachers, have only known this education system where, they're told that STEM is everything and it's all about the core subject and it's all about this knowledge-based learning. But actually, in dance and in performing arts and in music, that learning is embodied. And I think we're more disembodied than we ever were, because we spend that time behind screens. We've got children starting primary school who can't sit up for the length of the school day because they haven't got the core strength, because they haven't used their bodies in that way. So it's madness, isn't it, that we have to fight for dance, for drama, for music and art to be recognised as subjects when we're in this world where they're the skills that are needed more than ever, whether that young person goes into a career in the arts or not. And because we've got the worst ever obesity crisis in young people, the worst ever mental health crisis in young people, and yet we're eroding the very subject that then, you become an adult, and now we're seeing dance on prescription and arts on prescription. So why are we taking it out of the curriculum and then having to plug it back in via the NHS? As adults, it's madness. And I think, to your point on careers, there's, I'm sure everyone else has heard this as well, examples of young people who go to their careers advisor and they say, okay, you want to be a dancer, but, well, what are you going to do if you don't make it into the Royal Ballet or onto the West End? But dance is everywhere, our biggest mainstream Saturday night TV programme is a dance-based programme. It's in games design, it's in film, it's in intimacy coordination. Like, dance is in everything that we do. So a big piece of our work is that. It's about educating parents, careers advisors, young people, and changing their hearts and minds and their understanding of what the arts can be.
There's a disconnect, isn't there, I think, sometimes. I mean, you look at during the pandemic where the government's telling young people to, or artists to retrain. You know, we talk about, you know, the fiscal aspect of it, the amount that it's worth to the economy. It's a proper job. It brings in a considerable amount of money. Somebody was mentioning earlier, I think it was Chris from the Rhythm Studio. Yeah, I've been to South by Southwest in Texas, and we are, as a nation, very well respected internationally. You're absolutely right. It is something that we should be proud of, the creative arts. We punch, as you said, way above our weight. We absolutely do. Yet there's a disconnect in the country, and I find it strange. Certainly, again, I don't want to be a, you know, political, you know, I know creatives and teachers are famously right wing. it's worth money, yet a Tory government didn't seek to monetize that and didn't recognize the value of that. So there is a disconnect between. And I know there's new initiatives in creativity in the UK that the government are doing. But what do we do? I mean, how do we heal that disconnect between what we know and what we experience young people wanting to do, the jobs we know are out there, yet the barriers that we have to face to do that?
Very quick. I think that there's so many barriers. I mean, when it comes to the government side of things, Even the Tory government at least admitted in 2021 when they published their national plan that there was a music industry. Previous to that, the only idea of progression in music within government policy appeared to be progression towards conservatoires and getting better at playing an instrument or singing, as opposed to any of the other music careers or music pathways that you might choose to take. That's gone away now. We've got a new government, but the new government hasn't stepped up to the plate yet. They're talking about this national centre that nobody really knows what it is, and it appears that the government don't know what it is either. So there's a long way to go. The national plan that we originally had, actually, I thought read quite well, but nobody ever came up with any funding to actually make it happen. So it was just a piece of paper, unfortunately. So from a music perspective, I feel like nothing has really happened at all at government level in the last 4 years. GCSE and A level, as I'm sure it gets discussed within RSL, don't appear to be fit for purpose in any way, shape or form. Somebody in this room calls them music history exams, and I think that person is probably right. So huge amount to do, a little bit depressing.
I'm going to go off at a bit of a tangent off the back of that and try and find a positive that I sort of stumbled across recently. So as a project that's been in the news quite a lot that I've found myself involved with, it's the Oxford Cambridge Art East-West Rail thing, £80 billion project, and I was invited to lead one of three strands around skills on this. So there's a strand on technology, there's a strand on environment, and a strand on creativity. So I'm leading the creativity or creative industries component. And really, I found myself sort of borrowing from a guy called Alad from Anglia Ruskin, who's leading on sustainability. And he kind of shared into this report, and it's a big report. It reports into Patrick Vallance, Lord Vallance, so it's quite a big deal. And there were some announcements around funding and government prioritization this week, which is quite exciting. But the point is, Alad had kind of explained that around his realm of sustainability, the trigger for me was when he said, well, there's a kind of percentage of volume of jobs on LinkedIn that now include sustainability as a skill set in the title. It's not new jobs called I'm going to be a sustainability person, but in my job, whatever I do for a living, there's a strand which is sustainability. And that we're thinking, well, the same applies for creativity, doesn't it? You know, because I'm dealing in this region, which isn't a creative industries region. I think I was invited in because the work I do with the film industry, and they kind of half wanted me to go in and say, yeah, build a load of big boxes with lights on the ceiling and the film companies will follow. I didn't say that because it's not going to happen. So we had to think quite carefully about where creative industries and creativity sits. And I kind of adopted this mantra of creativity being a superpower. So dealing with, I mean, the companies involved are like AstraZeneca and Brands Hatch, and it's engineering, life medical sciences, and healthcare. And when it's kind of presented back to them thus, that, well, good luck with innovation if you haven't got creativity in amongst your mix of knowledge. So whether it's choreography, whether it's composition, whether it's filmmaking ideas, whether it's art, painting, graphic design, all of these things nurture creative thinking. and design thinking. And that is a superpower, and it's fundamental to innovation. So it's maybe how we pitch it, because, you know, if you just talk about the music industry or the film industry or gaming, you're kind of narrowing the kind of you're limiting the narrative, I think. Whereas if we're speaking with, I'm mindful of the audience, you know, if you're speaking with educators who are trying to semi-inspire parents, you know, we've established on this panel, as well as the students, and saying what's important here is that, you know, anyone at school or college who's going to graduate in 3, 4, 5, 6 years' time, good luck trying to guess what the jobs are going to be when you finish. What you're going to need is adaptability. You know, we just launched a new curriculum in digital arts, and a validation were asked, what jobs is this new curriculum aligning to? And our answer was, well, they probably don't exist yet, but there's a huge boom in immersive events. Everyone knows someone who's just been to some immersive show, good or crap, and come back and said, you've got to go or not. But there's a whole new realm globally in this area, and we don't really know what the jobs are called yet. You know, virtual production, it's still, you know, every company calls this role something different. But if learners can adapt and have got resilience and have got creativity woven into them and can problem solve and communicate and show empathy, then they've got a pretty good chance, and they can self-learn. That's a really vital one. You know, can you do this? Yeah, I can, knowing they can't. But you know, over the weekend on YouTube, by Monday morning, they're going to turn up knowing how to do it. That kind of, you know, hustle, all of that stuff is what's needed to prepare for an environment where new jobs are cropping up and old ones, you know, established ones are disappearing. But creativity is a superpower, is a thing. I hope that salient point got through in the end. It's yes. Creativity is a superpower.
And I like that wider thinking than thinking music industry, performing arts. You know, I like the strapline, something like the land of creativity, we have no borders, or something like that. I don't
know. Yeah, man.
But we're all there together, aren't we? You know, that, and I like that. But that's, as an educator, it broadens horizons, doesn't it? And that's what we're about, really. It's not limiting, putting people in boxes saying, right.
And we can't. I'm coming to Hannah's point about in-car audio and all the kind of audio dimensions. I mean, coming back to immersion and gaming and, you know, whatever else is going to happen next. Mm-hmm. An audio graduate that can kind of embrace spatial audio and learn, you know, the next format and adapt their skill set and capability to the next thing is the one that's going to get on. And you know, our job, all of us, I think, is to nurture that mindset mm-hmm. around adaptability and self-learning.
So you'd alluded to actually diversifying the courses at DBS, and yeah. It sounds like there's a similar sort of...
Very similar.
You know, ethos there, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important to think about higher education not as a transaction. You know, we put what will be 30 grand in and 3 years in, and we get a job out of it. And we know that is not true, especially in the creative arts, where that path is often non-linear and changes throughout your life, and it's about building a life in music and the thing that you love. So we rewrote our whole curriculum based around this idea of life in music and innovation and thinking about what that future might look like, but also why we choose music. And for many of us, it's not a choice, it's a compulsion. It's something that we just know that we need to do, and that's a wonderful thing. But then how do we help people keep that love throughout their life by being able to build a sustainable career? So not only do we kind of scaffold our courses towards innovation, and throughout the final year, every course goes through this exploration, realization journey of innovation, whatever that term means for them and their subject. But also we take a really place-based learning approach too. And particularly thinking about music and how grassroots venues and organizations have struggled so much. And what we want our students to do is, during their time with us and beyond, begin to create those opportunities and respond to the changing industry and industry, you know, surrounding industries, being able to use those skills of innovation, but also the networks and relationships and communities that they've built in their cities to create something new, to create that new job, that new opportunity for themselves and for others. And I think that's really exciting. So we've really tried to build the curriculum around that, and it be a curriculum that will move with the students and adapt to them and whatever comes next.
And in terms of creative performing arts, is it similar? Are you finding that the education is changing there and becoming more broad?
Yeah, definitely. That really resonates, that description of your courses at higher education. Because I think, you know, the olden days of, I'm going to go and do a degree and I will be trained to be a dancer or an actor, and then I will go out and I will be a professional dancer and I'll go and work in a company. Like, those days are gone, and it's really got to be about creating the artists of the future, because, you know, it's been said a few times, there isn't that clear pathway. There isn't, you're going to do this, you're going to pay your money, pay your fees and come out and get this job that's predetermined. It's got to be about those young people challenging and thinking and being the, you know, the company owners, the choreographers, the directors, the artists of the future, because they're designing what that future is going to look like. It's not us, it's not for us to do that. And I think that's an extra challenge when you look at that conflict with sort of the current primary Key Stage 3, Key Stage 4 curriculum, which is very narrow, very dry. It's not about thinking. It's not about working it out for yourself. It's about learning the facts and regurgitating the facts. So, you know, we're finding young people come into higher education courses and they haven't got that ability yet to think, to challenge. They're scared to challenge the status quo. They expect it to be that transaction where somebody teaches them the thing and they learn the thing and they pass the exam. So again, I think it's that whole like mindset shift. But, you know, like, and sometimes it feels that the education has become that you go to school, you learn the fact, you pass the exam, you get the job, you pay the mortgage, then you die, you know. And isn't life a little bit more than that? I hope it is. So I think we've got such a job to do, because we can teach young people through music, through dance, like what it is to be alive and what it is to feel the full range of human emotions. And I think that's massively missing from the education system currently, maybe unless you go to private school, and then you're probably fine.
Boo. So it sort of links onto the next question, and I alluded to it at the beginning. You know, I know all of you have a wealth of HE experience and industry experience, and we've got a lot of FE leaders here that have young people that are looking to progress onto that. I guess it's probably be quite valuable to hear about the skills, the things like, you know, being critical analysis, reflective practice, things like that. What are the kind of skills that you are looking for applicants? What can these people in the room take back and go, right, we need to make sure our learners are growing these skills or these personalities, these behaviours?
It reminds me of talking to one employer in a digital marketing agency, and they're obviously sort of some of the more forward-thinking people, kind of saying, well, I don't really care what they know. It's in order for them to be the right person to come and work with us, it's about who they are. And I think, you know, from that point of view, we're talking about the two things, the soft skills and the entrepreneurial skills. By soft skills, I guess I mean everything from being understanding and enjoying and being able to collaborate, but it's motivation, teamwork, trust, resilience, obviously, which is a hot topic, but also the entrepreneurial skills of actually being able to, as you were pointing out, I think, to think for yourself and to understand that failure can be part of your makeup, and that's often the way that you learn the most. So I think what I find often at postgraduate level is that some of those things don't feel like they're as advanced as I may have expected them to be, and that might be my own failing. It might be something about how growing up has changed through social media, COVID, or anything else. But certainly those are areas that feel like important spotlights to me.
If I could pick one thing, it would be curiosity. I think when I meet a prospective student and they ask me a question, I know that they are thinking about this deeply, and they are thinking about whether it's the right fit for them. And that's what I'm really concerned about, not just trying to sell our product to this young person, but that they're going to go on a journey with us and they're going to get a lot from it. So if they come to an interview with questions for me, I'm already impressed. You know, beyond whatever their creative or academic skill might be, I can see that there is that engagement there.
Yeah, I would echo all of that. And also add those interpersonal skills, being able to like in a meaningful way engage with other young people and adults and have critical debate and be able to respectfully, you know, hold their ground or have a disagreement with somebody. Those kind of real kind of gritty interpersonal skills that come through conversation, through collaboration, through trying something with somebody else and it doesn't quite work and you've got to overcome that, that live in the real world as opposed to kind of the social media presentation of, you know, oh, I did this and I had a really nice time doing it and look how great I am. That, like, being willing to embrace the mess that comes with creativity. It's not neat. It's not linear. We don't go from A to B. You've got to get into kind of the murky thick of it. So yeah, I would say young people who can do that and speak to other human beings.
People that are putting themselves out there, that want to get involved, want to ask questions about things, and not afraid of failure and do it once and try again. Yeah. And I guess that's what the arts is great for, isn't it? Because you know, that as a musician, that first gig, that's what you're chasing for the rest of your life, isn't it? That rewards, that, like, you've got that satisfaction and that gives you that drive to do it. So giving young people the opportunity to put that show on, get that feeling, and then say, right, I want to do that again and I want to learn more about it, yeah.
Making stuff all the time. I think, you know, a lot of courses require or expect a portfolio and you've got to be pretty brave, I think, to put stuff out there. And I think the, you know, not fear failure, learn from mistakes, all of that stuff, that mindset's vital. But I don't think it's fair to put that on young people necessarily. I think you come into curriculum design, I think it's our responsibility. My next soapbox would be, I think we're all pretty tired of, this arcane model of lining people up and talking at them in a classroom. I don't think many of us do that anymore, but, you know, schools are certainly bound by the budgets. Universities are increasingly bound by budgets. It's a hell of a lot cheaper to line people up and talk to them and give them a PowerPoint than it is to do something which is collaborative. But I think it's our job to be really creative in our curriculum design, to replicate industry, to take young people outside of their comfort zone routinely, all the time. You can't nurture problem-solving skills and communication, all the emotional intelligence, empathy. You can't build confidence by repeatedly talking to people when they're lined up. You know, people have to be given a supported environment which they can make mistakes and learn from them. So I think these things tie together, what we expect of students and what they should expect of us as curriculum designers and leaders. That's a vital relationship for me.
It's a really important point, isn't it? The lecturing is shown to have one of the lowest effect sizes in communication, isn't it? Unsurprisingly, you know, as an educator, our key job in a classroom is to check for learning, and you can't check for learning if you're talking non-stop, can you?
But learning by doing and active learning is perceived as expensive, and that's where our creativity has to come in. That's where we have to set up environments where that learning is accelerated in a sustainable, affordable way. That's tricky.
But I'm just thinking about, you know, in your shoes, working in FE, like, what can you do to ensure student success at higher education, if that's what they go on to do? And really, it comes down to helping them make the right choice. So that can look like a range of things, you know, from really early exploratory conversations with students about their options. Because there will be many that haven't considered university, particularly in creative arts, and there is still such a participation gap. You know, going back to our earlier discussion, thinking about free school meals, students, it's about 20-point gap difference, that, you know, those that go on to university. So actually, you've got a lot of work to do there in terms of self-efficacy and helping them unpick their experiences and those of their parents, and that work, like, it's too late for us to do a lot of that. We can do a lot of that other stuff, but that bit is difficult for us to do if they don't walk through the door. Although we do try with access and participation activity and all that stuff, but you've got them in front of you. So that work, but then also just going back to what I said earlier, really helping them make the right choice for them. Because if they want to be somewhere, then the things that they find hard, and they will find university hard because it is an uncomfortable transformational experience, if they know they want to be there, then it, that is a little bit easier. So just that, what's that journey of preparing them to make that choice?
It reminds me of I had a conversation with a young artist called Nairobi, who's a singer in a band called All Black Era. I met her through our friends at Youth Music, brilliant organisation. She's just the band of one of Mobo. They played at Glastonbury and they were on Jules Holland quite recently. And she said, you know, we didn't do GCSE music. The GCSE music, the music in school, was almost like, it's like a different thing to the music that we have. Music at school was if you had piano lessons. We didn't have a piano. You know, we didn't have enough money to do piano lessons. We didn't have violins. And that traditional, more traditional route, and I don't want to, GCSEs have their place. It was interesting what you said earlier, Phil, about music history, and I think there's an element of that. You know, today's modern industries in creative performing arts and music doesn't necessarily, maybe the syllabus is perhaps a little bit, needs updating, but it's not
just
accessible,
slightly.
Is it? It's not accessible. It's that wealth gap is the you know, inclusivity, we were talking about that earlier, but wealth divide is a huge thing and it's getting worse.
Absolutely. I mean, I see that so much in music tech. I mean, there's so many challenges in music tech representation. But what I really encourage applicants to do is, if they're not there yet, have a conversation with us and we will help direct them to resources and, you know, help them get there, because there is that gap. But, you know, you do wonderful creative work and you do provide an alternative to students. But I also know that many of them still are not, you know, not considering higher education until quite late in their qualification. So how can we broach that earlier?
I think one of the other exam boards invited us in and said, well, if you were able to design GCSE music from the ground up without the guardrails that the DfE have provided, what would it look like? And a couple of the things that we suggested, just because we wanted to provoke a reaction, was certainly, number one, why do you have to play an instrument? Why do you have to sing? You can be a music lover, a music fan, a musician, without necessarily playing or singing. And I think certainly at the moment, you have to read music and you have to be a grade five or whatever. So not just that, let's peel that one back. And the second thing that we suggested, well, why can't music begin in the year 2000? So not just binning Western classical music, binning the Beatles, binning Motown, binning, saying, what are the young people likely to be listening to when they get home? Sure, look at the history of that. Where did that come from? You can start, if you're whoever your favourite artist might be. But I think, you know, looking at these things from a completely new angle might actually... I think there's a lot to rip up.
Did you say it would look a lot like an RSL level 2 diploma? Is that what you...
I was rather waiting for that.
Yeah. Laura, you were trying to get in there. I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist.
It's quite all right. I forgot my point now. So that, to me, it's about, like, we as in a wider sector, like, have a piece of work to do about teaching teachers what excellence is, I think, in our subject. Because, you know, I'll go into a school and the teacher will go, oh, you'll like this one. You see her at the front, she's really good. And I go, oh, really? Why? Oh, she can do the splits. Brilliant. She's a bendy wendy. That's fantastic. But, like, but also I'm probably watching the kid at the back who's never danced a step in their life, but they're just, like, moving beautifully to the music, or they've got this really creative idea. And I think there's, like, such a narrow perception about what a musician is, what a good actor is, what a good dancer is. And I think there's, like, a whole piece of education that we have to do about that and what it is to be good at a subject, because it doesn't always look like people think it looks. And I think you're right that we have to create qualifications that meet those young people where they are, not just those who've played piano for 12 years, right?
I absolutely, fundamentally agree. The flip of that, though, yes, we have to meet young people where they are. And this is, it's easier for a university. We can design our curriculum with a, you know, relative freedom. So it's a bit unfair to make the point to colleges who are kind of beholden to something that's, you know, you choose and apply as best you can. But I think we have to find ways to challenge all of us like I said, it's a bit easier for higher education to challenge norms that, however established they are. And I'll give an example, and it's going to be around film and TV. So when I started my current role about just nearly 3 years ago, and I met the film team, it's an okay film degree, good people. They shared the documentation with me. I'd asked to see what the film program looked like and met with them. They said, so what do you think? I said, well, it looks like all the other film degrees I've seen in the four other universes I've looked at, and all the others I've seen as an external examiner over the last 10 or 15 years of doing what I do. And they were like, okay, fair enough. Is it okay? I said, no, not to me it is. And I've got a real problem with it. And they're like, oh, okay, but it's like all the others. I said, yeah, basically every film degree in the country, it's a bit harsh. There are exceptions, but not many. It's predicated on the notion that by the end of the third year, everyone's going to be an auteur, right? Everyone's going to be Spielberg or Kubrick or whatever. And so by design, everyone is delivering to the film industry precisely what it doesn't need. The film industry needs people that are specialist in, just look at the credits at the end of a film and look at different roles. And do you want someone who's going to come out of their degree saying, oh, I'm going to go up to the director and tell him what he needs to do? They're never going to work, ever, So it's about, looking at what the sector needs, listening, because there's loads of research that Screen Skills have done and the BFI have done on all of the granular detail around, art department. Art schools aren't connected with the film industry, yet the film industry is struggling to recruit to their art departments, people that can do set design and build and hair and makeup and prosthetics and all that stuff. So it's about looking at what the industry need is, as well as looking at the student and saying, okay, how do we ensure that that pathway that we put them on is going to lead somewhere? And be a bit bolder about that, I think.
I think that joined up thinking thing is really important. Certainly a conversation I seem to be having over and over again is how in so many different places, whether it's schools, colleges or wherever, the music department and the careers department have no relationship with each other. So careers people have no understanding of music pathways. The other piece of work that's never been done, and it's a piece on my shopping list that if I only had time, I would do, maybe one day I will, is it seems to me within the music sector, nobody has ever looked at entry-level jobs. What are they? How many are there in a particular year? Where do you find them? What are they? But on top of that, how many young people apply for each one? Anecdotally, I would say for every A&R person, because we all think we've got great ears and we all think we want to be an A&R person, the coolest job. So there's going to be 100,000 people applying for each one. Neighbouring rights specialist, maybe a half a person applies for that particular job because nobody knows what it actually is. If we get a little bit of an idea of which areas of the industry we need lots of people, anecdotally, still post-COVID, we need people to fill the events roles that people left because there weren't any jobs for a while. Digital marketing is growing and growing and growing. I think we should be doing degrees on fan-based building and digital marketing, but we don't, and I don't really understand why. So that there's no joined-up thinking there, it seems to me. I'm possibly simplifying it, especially when we're talking about music-related jobs in other industries. But it still seems to me to be a missing piece of the jigsaw that FE and HE, for reasons I don't understand, don't seem to want to understand themselves.
Just like to pick up the point about specialisms as well, because I totally agree. There's so much focus on being a multi-skilled creator and having a portfolio career, being able to do a bit of everything. And while there is obviously some weight to that, and I think having technical fluency and creative skills and soft skills is really important, having a specialism is really important as well, and to not lose that. And there seems to be a trend towards these quite broad degrees. We're expecting, young people to be able to navigate that like an experienced postgraduate student and just find their way. And that's just not, they need so much more scaffolding and they need training. And I don't like the word training often, but I think there is an element of that and that balance. So we've put back in, one-to-one tuition and coaching on instruments to really ensure that students are getting the value of their education and getting that real focus in developing a a really strong skill or two skills as well as this broad skill set. And I think that can sometimes be a bit lost.
And Laura, in terms of creative performing arts, where's the skills gaps then? I guess that's what we're kind of talking about. What could we be doing better? Where are the jobs and where are we missing that in creative performing arts?
I'd say certainly in dance, it's around choreography and kind of movement direction and intimacy coordinators. We're seeing that increasingly as a role on films and TV as well. But I think there are, I would say the kind of youth dance landscape isn't perfect. There are definitely gaps. It's definitely a postcode lottery, but there are programs that are out there for young people who want to perform, but much less in terms of young people who want to create dance or be directors or be writers and so on. So there's always going to be that kind of showbiz pull, isn't there, to, you know, wanting to be on a West End stage or, you know, wanting to be an actor or wanting to be in a film. But those like really creative roles that make dance happen or that make performing arts happen are definitely, they're more niche and young people have no idea how you would go into that. So like we run at One Dance UK a program called Young Creatives, which is designed exactly for that. And we've tried to take out any of like the language. So, you know, we used to talk about, hey, develop your creative practice. Well, what does develop your creative practice mean if you're a 13-year-old or a 16-year-old? So now it's like, do you like making movement? And we've tried to really demystify that. And some of our best young people coming through that program, they would never call themselves choreographers, but they like making dances in their bedroom. They like moving their bodies and trying things out. And so it's a pathway for them. So, yeah, I think it's in those kind of creative, not on stage, not in front of the camera roles that we're seeing the gap.
Great. I'm aware of time, and again, we could talk for hours and hours and hours. But thank you, everybody. I think let's have a quick opportunity to plug anything that you want to be plugging at the moment. Hannah, what's the latest album? Tell us.
I wish I had time for that. If you offer music courses, I know some of you do. Please do look at what DBS are doing. We've refreshed our whole program. We're really excited about it. Please do let your teams and students know and send them our way.
BA courses?
All BAs, yeah. 10 BAs across music, sound and events.
Fantastic, thank you. And Laura, what's going on with you guys?
So if you know any young people aged 18 to 25 who would like to apply for the Dance Ambassador Scheme, even if they're not wildly experienced in dance, that's okay. It's not a practical dance programme, but it's absolutely about kind of building volunteering experience, networking and so on. It kind of really especially supports those young people who maybe kind of from less affluent backgrounds or haven't had that chance to, you know, do the whole networking thing. So it's called Dance Ambassadors. Applications are technically closing today, but I can absolutely guarantee the form will be open until Monday. So have a look on the One Dance UK website if you know any young people that might suit.
Thanks, Laura. And Phil?
With my Pathways hat on, we're running 4 absolutely free Educator Pathway weekends early next year, one in Reading, one in Leicester, one in Canterbury, one in Norfolk. So if you're in those areas, please come and talk to me or look at our website, pathwaysintomusic.com. And if you know people in the Northwest, our conference is, as I say, November the 22nd at Band on the Wall in Manchester.
It's great to see you're going to, you know, not just being lazy and choosing to do your event in London like we have.
Well, we used to do it in Brighton. We got kicked out there of Brighton by Live Nation.
We did ask delegates where they wanted it, and everyone said London was the place that they wanted to do it. So, yeah, we're just going what the crowd wanted.
I got to plug a thing called Propeller, which we've been working on for a couple of years. It's the project we've been working on with the major film studios and BBC Studio Works. And really looking at trying to diversify the workforce in the film industry by breaking down that barrier that, if you've got the bank of mum and dad behind you, you can work for free, so you've got a competitive advantage. What we've designed over the last couple of years, and we launch later this year, we're doing a launch at BAFTA in December, is a curriculum whereby the aspiration, and I'm pretty confident it's going to work, is that from the second year onwards, students will be making independent feature films for streaming platforms and being paid living wage for their curricular work. So our customers that accrue that 40, 50, 60 grand worth of debt will at least have an opportunity to claw a bit of that back. So keep an eye on Propeller. It's a game changer. If we can pull it off, I think we will. We've got a lot of demand, a lot of support, a lot of interest. And I think we'll be very busy with applications if we can pull it off. So that's what we're doing at the University of Hertfordshire.
And I'll make sure we have links to everything that we've talked about that will go out in the materials. That's it for today. Thank you, everyone. We've got some drinks, I believe, have we, Patrick? Patrick's been to the offie. Yeah, yes. We've got some drinks and we've got some performances. I'd just like to say again, thank you, Access Creative. Thank you so much for having us today. It's been brilliant. It's been nice to, as I said, not do this in, you know, conference room B of Premier Lodge or something like that. It's been such a brilliant venue. It's lovely. Thank you to all our panelists, our guests, and thank you to you guys for coming. Please stick around and have a couple of drinks. It's been we've had a great day. So thank you for making it so. Cheers. Thanks again to Phil, Hannah, Laura and Stephen. I'd also like to give a special mention to all of the team at Access Creative in London who hosted the event. You've been tuning into the Creative Educators podcast from RSL Awards. You can find us on all the socials. It's either RSL Awards, Rock School or Stage School. And if you're looking into vocational qualifications, graded music exams or stage school exams, you can find us at rslawards.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.